now, without further ado, let's begin.
The most deadly shark attack in recorded history began on July 30th, 1945. The USS Indianapolis, a Portland-class heavy cruiser of the United States Navy, was taking part in a top-secret mission of the utmost importance. It was tasked with carrying enriched uranium to the island of Tinian in the South Pacific, along with other parts required for the assembly of the world's first deployable atomic bomb. As history shows, the crew of the Indianapolis were successful in their mission, completing the delivery in record speeds that are unbroken even by modern naval vessels. However, as they sailed back towards Leyte for training before the invasion of Okinawa, tragedy struck. Just after midnight on July 30th, the Indianapolis was spotted by a Japanese submarine. Without any escorts to defend her, the Indianapolis was a prime target, and the Japanese closed in for the kill. The Indianapolis did not have sonar to detect submarines. They were completely unaware of the danger in which they found themselves. At exactly 0:15 a.m., two Type 9-5 torpedoes smashed into the right-hand side of the vessel, instantly killing dozens of American sailors and causing obscene amounts of damage to the ship's structure. It took just 12 minutes of panic and terror for the ship to sink completely, taking down over 300 of the crew along with her. The surviving crew members, lacking life jackets and lifeboats, were set adrift among the waves in almost complete darkness. Many thought the worst was over, but their nightmare had only just begun. Naturally, the sailors floating among the debris were expecting to be rescued in a matter of hours, days at most. But the horrible fact was that no one was coming to their rescue. Despite sending several emergency signals before the ship went down, the Navy had somehow lost track of the Indianapolis. Nothing was made of the fact that the ship failed to arrive at Leyte, and many of the emergency messages that were received by nearby ships and naval bases were completely ignored. Declassified records later showed that one such commander in the Philippines was drunk and had told his staff not to disturb him. Another wrongly assumed the SOS calls were some kind of Japanese trap. The roughly 900 men who had actually survived the torpedo attack were now exposed to a new, perhaps even deadlier danger. It was dawn when the survivors saw the first sharks in the waters around them. The pure carnage and chaos of the sinking had attracted hundreds of the oceanic whitetip and tiger sharks from miles around. Some were apparently as large as 15 feet. It must have been absolutely terrifying for the survivors, seeing huge dorsal fins emerging from the water as the predators began to surround them, circling, picking out the weakest links, those too weak to struggle. At first, the sharks focused on the dead bodies floating in the water. Many men had died from exposure, salt poisoning, or thirst, and it was these corpses that provided the easiest meals for the circling sharks. But soon, the lifeless bodies among the survivors had been completely devoured by the hungry predators. It wasn't long before they turned their attention toward the living. The survivors later reported that they were losing at least 3 or 4 men to the sharks every single day. At some points, they counted 20 to 30 sharks in the water, their dorsal fins breaking the waves to form an almost impenetrable barrier around the surviving sailors. The sharks would often swim towards the survivors, bumping into them to test for signs of life. The sailors never knew exactly when the attacks would come, and this took a serious toll.
American Giant makes great clothing, t-shirts, jeans, and more, right here in the U.S., creating jobs in towns and cities across the country. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
On their sanity. Men would kick and pound the water, screaming bloody murder in an attempt to deter the sharks from attacking. But this only served to attract more and more of the fishy fiends, as it mimicked the thrashing of a wounded sea creature that served as a natural dinner bell for the hungry beasts. Every so often, a shark would lose patience and strike without mercy, rushing up from the briny depths to drag down a screaming survivor. Imagine it, hearing the man next to you let out an ear-splitting, blood-curdling scream before disappearing beneath the waves, never to be seen again. Some survivors recalled that the elements were perhaps just as deadly as the circling sharks. During the scorching heat of the daytime, men would pray for darkness, their faces blistering as the harsh Pacific sun beat down upon them. While at night, the water grew so cold that their teeth would chatter as hypothermia set in. Some would kick their legs and thrash their arms in futile attempts to keep warm. But again, this only mimicked the death throes of a wounded sea creature, making them a target for the circling sharks. As the floating sailors fought to survive, many of them succumbed to the horror of their experiences and began to lose their minds. Some men even began to hallucinate, seeing islands that weren't there, or claiming that they heard rescue planes searching in the skies above. One such surviving sailor recalls the heartbreaking moment that one of his shipmates finally lost his grip on sanity. The man claimed he could see the Indianapolis floating in the water just a few feet below them, and that he could access the mess hall's stores of purified water. He made repeated trips beneath the surface, inviting his comrades to join him in drinking the cool, fresh water he had found. But the man was drinking salt water. He died shortly afterwards from the effects of saline poisoning. Then, on the fourth day of their harrowing survival, a Navy seaplane happened to be passing overhead when they spotted the groups of surviving sailors floating in the waters below. One of the aircraft's crew members leaned out of the central hatch, waving down at the men. That's when the tears came. Tears of pure relief and salvation. They were saved. But out of the crew of almost 1,200 sailors, just 317 survived the ordeal. But for some, the horror, pain, and tragedy of the sinking would never end. Captain Charles McVeigh, commander of the Indianapolis, was one of the last to abandon the sinking ship. In November of 1945, he was court-martialed for failing to order his men to abandon ship in time, resulting in the 300 or so sailors that sank with the ship to the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. Cleared of this charge, he was instead convicted of hazarding the ship, a naval term which describes the failure of a captain to properly maneuver his vessel to avoid the likelihood of a direct torpedo strike. Yet aspects of the trial were controversial, as even the commander of the Japanese sub that sank the ship said that zigzagging the Indianapolis wouldn't have made a bit of difference, and that he'd have always found a way to sink her. The disgraced captain was cleared of all charges, was reinstated to his position, and retired as a rear admiral 4 years later, in 1949. Yet, while many of the Indianapolis's survivors agreed that Captain McVeigh was not to blame for their ship sinking, the sentiment was not shared by some of the grieving families of the fallen sailors. Captain McVeigh would often receive Christmas cards from the relatives of his dead crew members, but they did not have a remotely festive tone about them. Merry Christmas. Our family's holiday would be a lot merrier if you hadn't have murdered my son, read one card that McVeigh has received as late as the 1960s. Despite being cleared of blame, Captain McVeigh never forgave himself for his failures as a commander, even if it was during the most brutal and decisive war that mankind has ever known. Eventually, in 1968, McVeigh picked up a small toy sailor that reminded him of his naval service, walked out into his front lawn, and shot himself with the very same weapon that the Navy had issued to him upon entry into the service. He was 70 years old. Over 23 years later, the largest war in human history had senselessly claimed yet another life. During my teenage years, my family and I lived in military housing here in the U.S. A few doors down, there was a new couple with two kids, who were referred to me, since I made a little weekend cash working as a babysitter for some families who lived in base housing. Their house was pretty bare and undecorated, since they had only been moved in there for like a week or so. When I arrived, the mom was showing me around the house with a three-month-old baby in her arms, showing me where the baby's formula was kept, where I could get myself a bite to eat, stuff like that. I had to admit that I was a little worried about that particular job. 3 months old was by far the youngest baby I had ever sat for, and I'd be lying if I said I didn't think that the mom was having similar thoughts. However, they were only going to go to their welcoming event for a couple of hours, and it was right there on the base though, so not very far at all. I mean, what could possibly go wrong in such a short space of time? Well, something did go wrong, and it occurred at the very top of the staircase, as her three-year-old called her, and she was following me down. A strap on the mom's flip-flop snapped off, and she suffered a terrible fall, completely taking me out as she toppled hopelessly down to the bottom. And as she did, she ended up dropping the baby from her arms. Honestly, I'm not sure how it happened, as I am not exactly famous amongst friends for my agility. Quite the opposite, in fact. But as I was being sacked, I reached up and just sort of snatched the baby out of the air, grabbing a hold of her onesie and holding her up high as we hurtled to the bottom. I ended up with a black eye and some serious bruises, where the mom essentially bowled me over. But, thankfully, whenever I think about this, the baby was luckily completely unscathed. Whereas the mom, she ended up with an open fracture of one leg, right above her knee, and a pretty solid concussion. I mean, the wounds looked horrendous. She was bleeding all over that new cream carpet. But she did not act as if anything hurt at all, though. She just kept on saying, "Thank you. You saved my baby. You saved my baby." Over and over again. As the kid's dad called 911 and rushed an ambulance crew over to the house. They ended up paying me like $200 for a four-hour gig that night, which in 1987 was practically a king's ransom, especially to a teenager like me. But I don't think my pulse slowed down for a week. I'm serious about that. Sometimes I'd think about catching that baby out of the air, and I'd feel like I was going to have a panic attack. I pretty much stopped babysitting shortly after that, because that freaked me out so much. Not just the event, but word getting around like I was some superhero with cat-like reflexes, when I'm pretty sure if that happened again, I could not grab that baby if I tried. I know that sounds crazy, that I probably just should have soaked up the praise and used it to make a ton more money, but it was all just way too much pressure for a young person like me.
Thank you for joining us on this captivating journey. If you found this exploration as enthralling as we did, please like, share, and subscribe.